something I've been doing recently is interviewing a bunch of senior engineers at different companies. Just like, what does it mean to be the senior most approximately engineer at large company X or Y? And what are the skills that are valued there? And that's been really enlightening for me. A lot of them are skills you might think of as management skills, but built on a different foundation. So how do you, taking your technical excellence, learn to manage disagreement, to manage conflict?
Welcome to the PeopleStack podcast, where we discuss the intersection of people, work, and technology. I'm your host, Jen Bunk. I am a career coach for tech managers and CEO of the PeopleStack. My guest for this episode is Will Larson. He is head of foundation engineering at Stripe and author of An Elegant Puzzle, Systems of Engineering Management. Welcome, Will.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm just so excited to get to chat.
I am excited to chat as well. So let's kick things off so that we can get to know you a little bit better. Tell us about your engineering leadership role at Stripe. What's your mission there?
So Stripe, super high level, Stripe's trying to build the tools and economic infrastructure to accelerate economic and technological progress kind of internationally. And we sometimes just summarize that as kind of increasing the GDP of the internet. But then what does kind of the foundation engineering group do within that? And we kind of focus on three different types of solutions. We do data engineering, we do developer tools, and we do infrastructure engineering. But really, when you think about like what are the things that we're doing for kind of Stripe's users, like what are the things we do that like make Stripe a better product for people using us at the kind of most important bit? And I think about kind of like five major properties that are really important to us. And we work on Stripe security. You know, if Stripe isn't secure, it's almost better for us to be down. Security is like really fundamental to a financial product. Reliability, presuming we're secure, it's really important that we're not down, we're in fact up, so people can build their businesses on us. Take that really seriously. Then we also think about the usability of our product. Like, how do we make it easy to integrate with so like everyone can use it? And also we think internally, how do we build great developer tools so Stripe's engineers ourselves can be building better things for you? And then we think about kind of efficiency, like how do we make it so we can run this reliable, secure, usable infrastructure for like the cheapest price possible, which allows us to kind of like offer it to others cheaply. And then also latency is something we think about a lot as well in terms of like how do we make sure that it's actually quick to build on top of our infrastructure as well.
Okay. So is foundation engineering one of the teams, one of the orgs within the orgs? Is that how it's set up there?
So as a classic joke goes, naming is hard. So the way we think about it is that we have an engineering organization. And then within that organization, we have a number of pillars, you know, like five or six engineering pillars. So foundation is one of the pillars that an engineering organization is kind of built from.
Got it. Do you know offhand how many in engineering total? Like how many employees, how many people are we talking here?
So Stripe overall, about 1,800, and then engineering is about a third of that.
Okay, all right. So fairly big, really big to the startups of the world, where there might engineering teams might only be 20 or 40 or something like that. So do you find this to be a challenge? I'm just curious because I love getting people's ideas who work with both smaller and larger teams, but then also who are members of smaller and larger organizations as well.
So growth is kind of this eroding force, particularly for process, particularly for communication. So I think if you work at these larger or faster growing companies, there's this kind of meme that like every 6 or 9 or 12 months is a brand new company. And I think Stripe has such a strong culture that it's not that been my experience that it's a brand new company, but certainly different processes just don't work with scale. And every, you know, 9 months, there'll be a new process that is no longer scaling with us the way we want to kind of run like and operate like a effective company. I think like planning processes, for example, on the people side, like how we calibrate, has had to change performance kind of calibrations. I've had to change a number of times over the years, just as the number of people involved gets larger and larger. Nothing survives like two orders of magnitude of growth. And I think on the technology side, we're like, of course that's true. But on the process and kind of organizational side, like it's totally true as well.
Yeah, Yeah. And I know you have thoughts as well about team size. I came across that in the book. And I'd love to hear your thoughts. And I know that my listeners are going to get some value out of this as well. What are your thoughts on ideal team size for an engineering manager? Is there too big, too small, just right?
So my fundamental kind of thought here is you have to start like looking at the constraints and acknowledge the constraints and then figure out what the actual kind of real solution is versus kind of what you want to be. And there's kind of two, I think, important constraints here that are worth thinking about. The first is that many engineering teams, like one of the most important things that is happening, I think, in the last decade is you see more and more engineering teams directly supporting and operating their products in production. But that means like more and more of them are actually on call on a 24/7 basis. And to do that sort of on call rotation requires, in my opinion, effectively like 8 people, because that gives you the ability to have each person is on 1 week of the month. If you're doing a standard 2-tier on call rotation, and that's like one constraint I think is like incredibly important to be honest about. It's so hard to be on call. More than that you have to just be honest about it. And it's very hard to have a good on-call rotation if you only have one tier. There's like all these other kind of challenges if you change the other parts. The second piece, though, that I think is just as important is that there is like a pretty high fixed cost to having an engineering team, where like there are team meetings, there's kind of status check-ins, there's like planning. And if you have like too few people on a team, you incur like the whole fixed cost of having that team, but don't get like many of the benefits of it. So honestly, I really, really believe that you want a team to be 6 to 8 engineers. And then you could have like kind of the other pieces of that team, like maybe a product manager, a program manager, engineering manager, whatnot. One caveat I would throw out is that I think, particularly if you start managing managers, I found it's actually much harder to manage like 8 to 10 managers than to manage kind of 8 to 10 engineers. And so really depending on the mix of the folks you're supporting, that this like rule of thumb doesn't always work. You have to look at the constraints, then reason forward, like what the rule should be.
Yeah, well, rules of thumb are nice. Like here's a number to work with, right? But take a look at your context, take a look at, are you a director or a VP, or are you a manager, who's on the team? And then also a really great point, are you doing any kind of rotation or people on call? Then you would want more. Right. Is that why you said, so you said if people are on call, you want more like 8. So then it would be like 4 and 4. You'd have a couple, you'd be able to switch it around when who's on call.
Yep, exactly. I think if you have 8 people, then if you have 2 tiers like of on call, a primary and a secondary, then once a month, you will do one of those 2 tiers and then kind of flipping back and forth between the primary and secondary. There's like many strategies here, but this is the one that I think is quite common and seems to work quite well in my experience.
Yeah, that's great. I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's not been a topic that we've gotten into yet in terms of, you know, on-call size of the team. So that's why I asked about that. So changing gears just a little bit. So your engineering manager, who might have 6 to 8 members of your team, you're responsible for their care, for their feeding, for making sure they're staying engaged, for just really helping them out and being a wonderful manager. And part of that would be helping them out with career planning. And career planning is something that you touch on in the book and in actually multiple different places. And so as a career coach, this is something that it's a topic, obviously, that is extremely interesting to me, and I love discussing it. So I'd love to hear your thoughts in terms of looking at it first, career planning advice that you've received that has just been the best advice.
Maybe you should just be telling me how this works. I don't know if I don't know if anyone feels like they've really kind of cracked this one like perfectly well, but I can think through some of the advice that I've gotten over time sure. That has been really powerful for me. I think the core of good advice is that typically there's something you don't realize about yourself, or you realize but think isn't that important, that is in fact like very important, and you're like not able to see it for some reason. And I think a great example of this is one time my manager told me, like, you know, the thing you really need to learn, I was leaving my job thinking about what I wanted to do next earlier in my career. And he's like, the thing you need to learn is how to actually work with other people on a team. And I think, you know, earlier on, I thought I knew a lot, and I thought I had like this critical perspective that needed to be represented in all of our decisions. And, you know, I didn't know as much as I thought I did. And it also, like, having my perspective represented in every decision has turned out to be like relatively unimportant in my career. Like, you know, you want to be heard, but like often decisions aren't that important. You just need to do something reasonable. And so I think that advice, like, go somewhere where you can find a team to really be part of that team, not go somewhere to lead, but go somewhere to learn how to partner, I think was a really important piece of advice for me that was really shaping, in particular because I just at that moment, no awareness that was like the advice I needed. And I think would have assumed I should have done the opposite.
Okay. Yeah. Let's pick that apart a little bit, because I definitely want to talk about career ladders or career trees and whatever metaphor you want to use. I want to get there. But you said a couple of things that just really intrigued me that I found that can be really hard to pick up. And one of them was about decisions and decisions that leaders make. That, and so are the decisions really important? Which way do we go? Right? I can go here, I could take path A and I could take path B. There's gonna be constraints either way, there's gonna be pros and cons either way. And one of the things that I've certainly found as a leader, as a as an entrepreneur, or somebody who built my own business, that it's better to just make a decision than not. Because if you don't, you're going to stay where you are right now at the crossroads. As long as you say, okay, I'm just going to go this way, and then you figure it out. So, but we can still get stuck, especially when we're from an engineering background or a data analytics background, we can get stuck in that indecision. Oh, no, it needs to be the best decision. I don't know, I need to mitigate all risk. So I'd love to hear more of your thoughts on that.
I got very similar advice to what you just described at my first job. My first job in technology, rather, Bill Michaels, who was kind of the head of product for the group I was working with, said something very, very much kind of identical to what you just said, which was, it's better to make a decision and then find out it's bad and fix it than to wait too long to make any decision. And I think that is something I've really thought about. I really think decision-making is often important, but there are very few decisions that you make in career planning, but also like more generally, are permanent. And I think something I personally struggled with really, really a lot early on was the sense that like every decision was kind of this existential crisis to make the right decision on it. And if I got it wrong, it was like really kind of meaningfully important and damaging. When in reality, you can actually just have the same conversation the next day. Or maybe it needs to like wait like a year to have the conversation again. But there are vanishingly few decisions you make that are permanent. And by believing they're permanent, you put so much pressure on them being exactly right that you get stressed out, you get start like freaking out a little bit. But it's actually like, if you just were able to understand this as like, there's going to be many rounds of this decision, then you can de-stress it and you can try to like get to the right decision for the current kind of moment versus just really trying to make the right decision for all time, which is one, like sort of impossible, like context continues to change. And two, it just puts so much pressure on the situation that you're no longer partnering. You're like kind of expressing like fundamental beliefs about the future, which maybe aren't that important to the decision you're making anyway.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree more. And decisiveness is one of the core components, one of the key qualities of being a great leader. And not that like it's possible to be like perfect. I don't think it's perfect at anything, right? That I figured this all out. I'm decisive now. Or it's always a learning journey, and there's always a way to get even better. But to do exactly what it is that you just said, and realizing the impermanence. That's such a huge piece of it, the impermanence of so many of our decisions. You can change your mind. You can you can cut across path A to path B if you decide that you want to do something else, or in either, but either way that you learn. And so, right, because our careers are so important, like we make so many important career decisions. Do I stay or do I go? Do I go for this promotion or do I wait a little bit longer? Or, you know, I lost my job. Okay, now I'm on the job market. Maybe you get laid off or whatever, the company closes. Now I'm on the job market again. What do I do, right? It can just be so debilitating, but it's just moving forward, saying, okay, what's the next step? What's the next step?
So my father was a professor of economics and retired a couple of years ago. And it's always interesting talking to him. Because I realized, you know, talking to him sometimes that I've started to internalize this narrative that like your career in tech is 12 or 14 years long. You can kind of get into it and you're like, oh, this like the ageism and how we hire and evaluate people in tech is going to cut my career short. And so I'm exiting my career when in reality you're still entering it. And I think that creates another level of pressure where it's, you kind of can start to believe that this is the last time I get to make this decision about what I get to do, when in reality you're still really early in the career and you should still be thinking about how do I keep learning and growing versus kind of this like, how do I maximize the returns in this brief window before kind of ages and like shuts this opportunity down.
Ageism does exist, I think, to a certain extent, but there's always going to be challenges. And so your career doesn't need to get cut short. I mean, I think that other people think about that like retirement, like there's only X years until I retire. Like they think that when I turn 65 or 67 or whatever age, I'm suddenly just, my career is over. But it's the people who I see, well, I don't even know if I'm going to retire, like, and have more stretchy definitions of what retirement might look like and more individual definitions. Like, I don't know that I'll ever retire, or maybe retirement will look completely different for me. So then it doesn't have to be, oh my God, I only have 10 more years or I only have 15 more years, that there's a lot more flexibility there. Again, to the impermanence of it, right? That it's not this set thing that just because everybody else does it that way or has done it that way doesn't mean that that's the way that you need to define your career. So that's what that reminded me of as well. Let's talk a little bit about career trees, career ladders. I'm curious your thoughts on this specifically within engineering. Do we need career ladders and career trees? Let's start there.
I think at certain size of company, you can kind of commit any number of sins and get away with it. Say if you have like five people, particularly if there are five people that have been working together for a long period of time, you don't need much for that group. That group can just work on like the core group dynamics. It doesn't need a ton of structure. But at some point, you do get to a place, and I would say, you know, once you have 20 engineers, I think you certainly are in that place. Where you want to have this sort of structure. I think there's a few reasons why having these career ladders is very important. Once you have career ladders, you have the ability to say like who your role models are. You can say like, hey, this is the senior engineer, the staff engineer, and these are the behaviors you should be learning to emulate. And I think that is such a powerful force. But then also you have this like kind of clear codification of what are your values and not your kind of abstract values of like, you know, like justice and truth or something, but like, what are the things you're actually going to like pay people more for? Like, what are the things that you're going to like promote people for? And I think there is like a lot of kind of aspirations hitting the ground in terms of like who you promote and who you like pay well, is I think like a really important expression of like your actual values. And that's where real guidance in the career ladder, I think, is so valuable. And it's also then each performance cycle is like an opportunity for you to look at yourself and it's like, are these performative values or are these like our actual values? And then it's an opportunity to like update that ladder, like express like your actual values, or to like reflect on yourself, like how would you like to change how your culture is evolving to like be more of what you want?
Yeah, that's a great point. And also, they can be helpful for folks earlier in their career, certainly later in your career as well, but earlier in your career to have a sense of, all right, this is at least, I'm not just moving forward in my career without any sense of what's possible and what's above me or what's next, that this is a relatively structured way to think about it, so it can have something to aspire to. And one of the topics that comes up a lot when I talk with folks in engineering orgs, and also individual contributors. So I get questions a lot from individual contributors, developers, programmers, who say, yeah, I know that to level up, one way to do it would be to go into management. That's obvious. But I'm not sure that that's actually what I want to do. So I'm curious, Will, what you would say to an individual contributor who says, I want to continue to up-level myself and really grow and learn, but I don't want to go into management. What options do they have?
I think it's easy to look at management. To the previous point about the permanence of decisions, I think going into management is not a lifetime commitment to be a manager. And I've seen a lot of folks who are great engineers and then are, for short periods, great managers, but decide it's just like not the kind of life they want to lead, and then like pop back to being engineers and are still great, but now they're great with like a broader toolkit and more kind of empathy for like why managers sometimes ask for things that seem sort of nonsensical, but now they have this like better intuition of like, oh, there's probably like this happening behind the scenes they can't share with me for very reasonable reasons. So it's not permanent. It's worth giving it a try if it's something that you are kind of borderline interested in. You won't get trapped. That said, it's not the only way for sure. And I think most companies now have these dual career ladders. And a topic that we talk about a lot here, but also I think many places, like what is the actual representation in the populations at different levels? So if you have like a staff engineer equivalent, and if you have two ladders, there's going to be some manager level that is equivalent to that staff engineer. And how many people are staff engineers, or what percentage of people are staff engineers versus what percentage of managers are staff equivalent managers? And is it fair? Like, is it easier to kind of get promoted on the manager path or on the engineer path? And I think this is another place that it's really powerful for us to be like reflective of the kind of data of our aspirational values and our actual values, and then looking at that gap and the kind of working consistently over time to true up the reality and the aspirations to kind of match. So some things I found really powerful here are, I think mentorship is the first place that I think people start really developing themselves as engineers, as you help other people kind of start growing their skills. And it's not just kind of navigating your code base, although that's a critical kind of skill to help people with, particularly earlier in their career. But how do they actually run important projects? How do they influence people? Something I've been doing recently is interviewing a bunch of senior engineers at different companies. Just like, what does it mean to be the senior most approximately engineer at popular company or large company X or Y? And what are the skills that are valued there? And that's been really enlightening for me. A lot of them are skills you might think of as management skills, but built on a different foundation. So how do you, taking your technical excellence, learn to manage disagreement, to manage conflict, to actually get people kind of moving forward where people don't believe that it's politics that is making some decision, but actually can like two different groups with different opinions about the right approach can believe that reasonable decision was made that is actually responsible to the company and kind of represents their perspective well. And I think it's easy to be like, oh, that's a management skill, but actually like senior leadership has like a set of skills that transcend management or engineering. They're like fundamental to leadership itself.
Yeah. All wonderful points, especially about you're not going to get trapped in management. You can give it a shot. And if you don't like it, there's always going to be other options for you. And taking a hard look. And so this is looking at from the perspective of leadership, taking a look at how easy versus hard is it to say, get promoted up to a staff engineer or something equivalent versus a manager. And if there's way more managers than the staff engineers, what does that say? Is it that it's too easy, or maybe it's just that we're not making it clear enough, or managers aren't having enough conversations with their individual contributors about, hey, there's a path over here as well that you can become the superstar individual contributor, you know, the superstar staff engineer who is really like creating new code bases and going out and doing TED Talks and really just becoming an expert in that area. And that's how you can be a leader that way. And I think that a lot of companies just don't do that because we don't talk about that as much because, oh, you're a manager, right? You are an individual. I mean, this happens in every industry. I talk with friends in other industries too. It happens in every single one. Oh, you were an individual contributor. Now you get to be a manager. It's like, okay, what else is there? So it sounds like you, at Stripe, there is at least a structure for, there's at least two different paths. There's the IC and there's the manager. That's great to hear.
Hi, everyone. We'll get back to the interview in a jiffy. But first, are you a tech manager? In other words, do you lead teams of geeks through long-term complex projects? Do you feel like you're wasting precious time going to useless meetings, dealing with administrative nonsense, and working late nights? Are you working 50 plus hours a week, but don't have the salary to show for it? It doesn't need to be that way. You can build thriving, high-performing teams who produce a measurable positive impact while earning the premium salary you deserve. Oh, and you don't have to work your butt off to get there. If this sounds like the kind of success you're striving for, then go to jenbunk.com/webinar to reserve a spot in my free masterclass. I share the 4 shifts that my tech manager clients made to achieve badass career transformation. That's jenbunk.com/webinar. Without further ado, please enjoy the rest of the interview.
So, changing gears now, another topic that I'd like to talk about, which is equally, if not more important than career planning, is diversity and inclusion. So, starting off with that, what I'd like to focus on here are actions, daily actions, little things that if a whole bunch of us do it, that we can actually improve diversity and inclusion, especially in tech. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
So there's a lot to say about kind of inclusion and diversity. And so maybe first, I think one of the important trends that we're seeing the last, you know, couple of years get like more and more clear is this idea of kind of inclusion precedes diversity, where if you think about what's necessary for maintaining a diverse organization, if you hire, if you have a really diverse like pipeline of candidates, but they, as they join your company, don't stay, then that doesn't accomplish anything, and it's like potentially quite harmful for the folks who like go through that experience, right? So the first thing that I've really focused on, I think, and I think the industry in large has really started to come to understand, is that inclusion is like the building block. So like kind of starting there a little bit, although glad to kind of talk through kind of the entire problem space a little bit. There's a few things that I've come to believe are really important. And I think about for inclusion, kind of like membership and opportunity. So membership is like when you come into work, do you feel like you belong? Is there a community that you feel comfortable with and feel seen by? And is that a community that is kind of a core valued part of the company? And then opportunity is like there's like scarcity in companies for like the most important roles. And how do you actually get access to those important roles? And so talking a little bit about the latter bit, a few things that I think are useful, maybe just a couple of measurements I think are useful to think about as you're tracking yourself and then think about how do you actually move those measures specifically. Mm-hmm. I think the number of kind of underrepresented minorities, number of women, kind of depending on the country you're in, like how you think about these things might change a little bit. But how many kind of URMs or women are in your senior most roles and your leadership roles. Having role models is so important because it's a statement that if you stay and are great, you can be successful to any extent. in this environment, right? And so like looking at the number on the representation and senior kind of leadership and role models there that you can like feel represented by is I think one measure to think about. And that's both for folks hired in and folks who are grown up within the company. I think both are like quite important. And then the other one, which I think is really important, is like the number of different folks who are getting key projects and roles. So if there's this idea of like a staff project, like a project you would need to complete successfully to become like a staff engineer. And there's not many of them. And like, how do those get handed out? How do you get access to those? So something that I've worked on really closely with the team here and that I'm like really proud of, I think these are two most important efforts that we've put in. And I want to caveat before I go into them and saying like, these are actually very time consuming to do. And so there's this idea that like leadership is showing up. And I think that's true where as I talk through these are things you could do today, but they take a lot of time. And it's just like not possible to make progress on inclusion or anything else that's important without putting a lot of time into it. And so I think showing up and putting the time in is how people ultimately know what you value. And if you don't, because it's too much time, you have to reflect on kind of the gap between who you want to be and the values you want to have and kind of the values you're demonstrating, right? So the two things I would kind of recommend that we've done here, I think successfully, not perfectly, but successfully are first, we rolled out this, we have this idea of DRIs, which are like directly responsible individuals. And so for important projects, we have this idea of who is the DRI, the person who's going to be leading it. And so we rolled out a very structured mechanism for selecting DRIs, where for an important project, and typically how do you decide to run the process or not is kind of, is there a scarcity around projects like this? If there's going to be many projects like this, we don't run the process because it's too heavy. But if there's only going to be one, there are more people who might want to lead it than are like projects to lead it. Then we run these processes. But first, you have to communicate out widely that you have this project coming up. And you have to ask people to apply. And you have to let them know like the actual time commitments, expectations around participating in the project. And have a clear process to apply, like email this person by this date. And then you'll get some people starting to kind of subscribe. But then the next step, which took us a while to learn, and what wasn't obvious to me initially is then you have to go look at who are all the people who might be able to do this and go nudge them. A lot of people, if you don't go to them and like say, hey, I think you'd be really, really strong at this project, won't do it. They just won't think to apply. They might not feel safe applying. They might feel they might feel like, I don't know if I could do it. Like, am I actually ready for it? And that's not typically, it turns out people's ability to evaluate their own readiness for projects is more a reflection of just kind of their self-confidence than the actual their capabilities. So going and nudging them, I think, really helps people to apply. Then from that, you have to apply some sort of like structured framework of how you select people. And what we've done there is when we send out the initial email, we try to say like the criteria we're using to select. And then for each person who applies, we try to tell them why they were not selected if they weren't. So they actually get feedback about what might they focus on if they wanted to be selected for a subsequent project of this shape. Mm-hmm. And then certainly we also tell the person who is selected that they're selected and get them to kind of act that they're actually, commit yes before we kind of send it out. And by doing this and tracking who we select, we actually have like a rich data set of kind of the cardinality of people who are selected for critical projects. This is really time consuming and it's sort of a frustrating process to run, to be honest, but it works really well. And so that is one. And we do a similar process to make sure we consider internal candidates for kind of important positions internally that open up, creating visibility, nudging folks, letting them apply, and then making sure they get feedback to the extent that it's not quite the right fit for them at that time.
Yeah, there's so much that I love about this because, I mean, it feels very much like a hiring funnel, right? And it's, why would you approach these any differently? Is almost after you explain it, it's like, oh, this makes so much sense, but I never thought of it that way. And also because one of the things that's really hard is very often, just like in any meeting, the loudest person is going to get the most time. The loudest person, the most, you know, extroverted person, or the most seemingly confident person might end up getting one of these, you know, one of these spots on one of the key projects or a promotion. And this really, it democratizes it. It makes it more fair so that everyone who can have a chance, even if they think that they didn't, but yet, hey, I think you do, can actually go through the process. So that's just my initial thoughts on that. But yeah, also I could see that it's work in the sense that you have to track it. You have to go through the process. You have to, even just the nudging people to apply can take weeks if you let it. But it's all just part of building that culture of, hey, we care and we want to make sure that everybody has that opportunity. And so this is something that you all have successfully done at Stripe. And so I'm curious if you don't mind sharing, I'm just curious through the next, so like the next iteration, what might you change about it? Like, what have you learned along the way that's to kind of dial it in even more?
So I think the first thing I think we learned was around the nudges. I think the second thing we learned was like this idea of scarcity, and the process is too heavy to run for kind of non-scarce opportunities. And trying to run it less because it does work, but it is like heavy to run. I think the biggest challenge with it is basically twofold. I think one, it still is heavy, and I'd love to figure out how to run it more cheaply. Like one idea, so in any company, there's like a lot of kind of confidential projects, and so how do you have people publicly apply to confidential projects? For example, if you want to do like an acquisition evaluation, it's like sensitive and you can't simply like tell the entire company while being respectful to the company that you're having these conversations with. And so one of the ideas we've been playing around with is like kind of prematerializing a list of people who want to be involved. So then as these things come in, could have them kind of just pop off that queue to kind of be involved in these projects where we can't, and it's also too time sensitive, where we can't just like wait for a week for someone to apply. So what if we, for these sorts of like rare kind of confidential ones, which tend to be like relatively fixed in size, like maybe this is 20 hours, but it's not like a year of work. Maybe we can do something like that to kind of get ahead of it. And that has been the biggest thing that I've been thinking about is just timeliness, confidentiality or sensitivity ones, and then how do we make it lighter weight? And I think the prematerializing helps a little bit with that, but we're still trying to figure out how to make it easier to run it more often.
Yeah, and the fact that you're even doing it, like you said, you show up, you do it, and then if it's something that continues to be valued, then you'll figure out how to work out the kinks and run it more efficiently, and keep the effectiveness in there as well. And this is just, it's the harder approach to diversity and inclusion that, again, I think a lot of people just don't talk about. We can talk about it from the hiring funnel. Let's make sure we can get in as many, you know, as many folks from underrepresented groups as possible. And you do that through the sourcing and the recruiting and that whole process. So, and that's almost more obvious, although it's not, even in this day and age, I don't think it's completely obvious how to do that well. We were figuring that out. But this is kind of looking at it from, let's build an organization that values inclusion. And then that's where there's going to be the role models. And that's what's going to then attract more people of different colors, of different ethnicities, different backgrounds, different, you know, minorities to us. And so if we kind of approach it from both ends, yes, it's work, but of course, this is what we want, right? We want all voices to be heard. We want everyone to have opportunities. So it's great to hear that such an awesome organization like Stripe, which I love, by the way, I was going to mention that I use it for my business, that is doing these kinds of things and kind of being at the forefront of it. So I appreciate you sharing that, Will. So we are almost up on time. I'd love to keep talking about some of these topics even more, but in the interest of time, last question. This is a question that I ask all of my podcast guests, and that is, what is the biggest people-related challenge in your job?
So this is a broad question. There's a few different directions you can kind of go with this. I think the obvious one that maybe I will not go with is hiring. I think hiring is always the most important, highest leverage, most potentially impactful for good and for bad activity that you can take on. And I think almost nothing is more important. A few others that I won't go into are, you know, training. I think when you're growing quickly, getting people up to speed quickly is hugely impactful on your ability to grow at a rapid pace. And if your training improves for people to get up to speed in 2 months instead of three, it lets you absorb far more people effectively than if it takes longer. But the one I would go with is actually helping people kind of deal with the perpetual buffeting churn and shocks of just rapid organizational growth. Like helping people process change more quickly. I'm not uniquely good at processing change, right? Like processing change is really uncomfortable, particularly when a company's growing quickly, it takes so long to get comfortable and you're like, oh, I finally feel safe. Then it changes again. You're like, oh no. I just got it and now it's gone again. And so how do you help people do that? And particularly, I think you get to a certain point in your career where you have you actually master some level of self-confidence where you're like, I know the business cares about my work and values my work. So it's easier to kind of deal with these shifts when you have that kind of confidence in your value to the business or whatnot. But it's much harder for people who don't have that privilege to feel safe and comfortable at all times. And they can feel like they're getting kind of locked out of opportunity. Fast-growing companies are in some ways like a pyramid scheme where if you get in early, things kind of grow out behind you and you kind of get pushed up. And there's kind of that remarkable opportunity. But as companies slow, the pyramid scheme unravels, as all pyramid schemes do. And so helping people come to terms with that and find different strategies to get the growth they want, and to make sure they feel recognized in ways that the company can still provide, which might not be kind of how they played it out in their head, a year or two before.
Mm-hmm. That's a great one. And besides building our own self-confidence and building your own self-confidence, which is absolutely a way to learn how to deal with and cope with change, is there anything else from your own personal growth and development or from supporting your team, any other strategies that have you found are helpful in dealing with rapid organizational growth and change?
Somewhat controversially, I'm more of a satisficer for most decisions than kind of an optimizer, where there are a few things that are very important to me. And I'm really, really focused on getting those exactly right. But for most things, I'm like, is this critical? And I'm like, no. And I will kind of do something reasonable and move on. And I think for a lot of these decisions, you have all these opportunities around you and you can look at them. And it's like, this is not perfectly aligned with what I want. And you're like, I'm not going to do it. But I've really focused in my career on taking the best available opportunities and really doing everything I can with them. And so I think, for example, one of the projects I'm most proud of at Stripe that I got to be involved with was the launch of Increment, which is our kind of web magazine. And it's just this amazing thing. And I got to learn so much watching people like Susan Fowler, Sid Orlando launch and grow that. And I would have never rationally decided to kind of be part of a web magazine. But it's just been so enriching and it's been such an amazing project to be a small part of and then get to cheer for from the side, where I think just looking at those opportunities and participating, even if they're not obviously the right thing to kind of take you to that next promotion or something, has been really rewarding for me.
Yeah. And I remember you mentioning in the book that Exactly that, right? That so many people can get stuck in like the linear kind of thinking, like, okay, what's next? What's the next promotion? What's the next raise look like? And, you know, and just sort of do that. But that you can just get so much tunnel vision that way because you can miss out on so many other opportunities if you just do that. It actually reminds me of when I was in grad school, my grad school advisor, so basically said to me, don't just focus on the thesis and the dissertation, Jen. Those are just the hurdles. Enjoy it while you're here because those are like the main hurdles in getting your PhD, right? You got to write your thesis, defend your thesis, write your dissertation, defend your dissertation. And I know that I was getting hyper-focused. Like she asked me if I wanted to get involved in a project. I said, no, I need to focus on my thesis right now. Thinking in my head, that's what my advisor wants to hear, right? I'm going to focus 100% on my thesis. She's like, no, I want to see you do this. And I want to see you do this other thing too. And they ended up being, you know, some of the most amazing projects that I was involved in. So similar with your career, that's wonderful. That's wonderful advice to do the things. Maybe it's not completely in line with what you had thought was going to happen, but hey, if your heart's in it, you're excited about it. Why not do it? It's wonderful advice. And so with that, I think that's a really great place to end the conversation for the day, at least, Will. Great talking with you today. And I want to give you a chance if people to talk just a little bit about the book for people to check out the book, but and also if people want to follow you. So where's the best place that people can go to either pre-order or order the book?
So the book is out now. If you go to Amazon, search for An Elegant Puzzle, it's there for you. It would love to go home with you, as many copies as you can possibly fit in your home. Yeah. So that's the best place to get it. And it's just been, I don't know, could do a full hour on just the experience of kind of launching a book. It's just been like very humbling and kind of remarkable set of learnings itself.
Yeah. So the book again is An Elegant Puzzle, Systems of Engineering Management. And was it, I think I noticed it was Stripe Press that published it. Is that what it is? So this is, they have their own publishing company. I didn't know that.
So this is, I think it's the fourth book, might be the fifth. I think it's the fourth book from Stripe Press. Really awesome project that Stripe's launched. Very small team internally. But how do we actually create like ideas for progress is kind of their tagline, which is finding these like really powerful ideas and getting them out there. And if you think back to our mission of like how do we increase the kind of the GDP of the internet, we really do believe that ideas along with technology are kind of core facilitators of that. And this is kind of the motivation behind the project.
Well, that's so wonderful. That's great. I'm glad I asked about that. And then if people want to follow you online or elsewhere, where's the best place to go?
So the best place to go is search for my blog, Irrational Exuberance. It's at lethane.com, lethan.com. Also Twitter, you know, all of the random social medias are up there as well.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for taking the time today, Will. Great conversation.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This is great.
All right. That was Will Larson, folks, head of Foundation Engineering at Stripe and author of An Elegant Puzzle, Systems of Engineering Management.